One particularly intractable aspect of homelessness is chronic street alcoholism. Each homeless alcoholic was costing the public tens of thousands of dollars a year, in some cases more than $100,000 a year, for ambulances, emergency room visits, and other care. Then 10 years ago, a social service agency tried a new approach. The result was 1811 Eastlake, a facility to house 75 homeless late-stage alcoholics. And they're allowed to drink in their rooms.
I don't think we just throw people away because they can't stop using.
Bill Hobson is executive director of Seattle's Downtown Emergency Service Center. That's the group that runs 1811 Eastlake. He told KUOW's Marcy Silman about the reaction he got when DESC announced they were going to let homeless alcoholics drink in their housing facility.
When we introduced this concept publicly, it seemingly upset everyone in the Western Hemisphere that we were going to house late-stage alcoholics and not require that they stop drinking as a condition of tenancy.
Why was that so upsetting to people?
I think that in most citizens' minds, there is an idea that's been implanted by decades of abstinence-based treatment ideology and just-say-no politics that has convinced the general public that the only way you can deal with an addict is to insist on withdrawal, that he withdraw from substance use. In most instances, that works for a lot of people, and we should be thankful for that. But we shouldn't allow the success of abstinence-based approaches to addictions to blind us from the reality that there are subsets of the addicted population it most decidedly is not working for. What do we do with them?
What do you do at 1811?
Well, we house them, and we work with them in a whole multitude of ways, trying to help them rediscover what we social workers will refer to as activities of daily living, preparing their own meals, going to market, buying healthy foods, not subsisting exclusively on fast food that they get out of a deli somewhere.
So looking back at the decade, what's your assessment of your facility and its effectiveness?
Well, I think it's been very effective on two dimensions. I think that we have successfully worked with people that to reduce the harmful effects of alcohol consumption. And there was 1811 has been researched quite a bit, and a lot of that research has been published in peer-reviewed academic journals. And one of the most notable publications was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It was our first publication that showed that in the first 12 months there was a 30% reduction in alcohol consumption. But I think one of the real successes of 1811 is not just reducing the harmful effects of an addiction on the individual addict. It's also reducing the harmful effects that the addict is inflicting on the broader community. And one of the big success stories that the JAMA paper that was published in 2009 demonstrates that in a 12-month period of time, there was a $4 million reduction in cost of use in the EDs of our hospitals and our jail use.
So in your mind, the biggest success is this sort of mutual reduction in harm, the harm to society and the harm to the individual. Right. What other stories do you look at? What other people stick out in your mind?
Well, one of the first residents in the building was a Vietnam vet, and he had been on the streets of Seattle almost 20 years and addicted to alcohol during all that period. Within 14 months on his own, with our support, the guy got sober. And he lived in the facility for another 14 months and then ultimately moved into an apartment up on Capitol Hill. Within a year or so, got himself a job. He has since married. He's working productively. I don't want to mislead your listenership that is typical at 1811. It's a pretty extraordinary story when you think about the years of dysfunction that the guy lived with. But it is a pretty remarkable testament, I think, to the resiliency of human beings that are living with addictions.
10 years later, what is the need in both Seattle and King County wide for facilities like 1811? In other words, how many homeless people with late stage alcoholism need homes?
Whether or not there's a need in our community for another building 100% dedicated to this population is kind of questionable in my mind. This subset, the late stage chronic alcoholics, is actually a very small subset of the single adult homeless population. A much greater subset are homeless people living with severe and persistent psychiatric illnesses. And that's what the bulk of our housing is dedicated to. Now, it's still predicated on housing first, moving people in without any preconditions placed on them other than paying rent and being nice, and don't do harm to the neighborhood that the building is located in. But that is a much larger group of people, and we've tended to address them since 1811. The subsequent six housing projects that we've developed, 100% of those units are populated by people living with major mental illnesses, and about 45% have a co-occurring substance abuse disorder.
Bill Hobson is here. He's executive director of Seattle's Downtown Emergency Service Center. We are speaking not just 10 years after 1811 opened, but also 10 years, a full decade into King County's 10-year plan to end homelessness. So where are we? How do you?
I think I've heard about that plan.
Yeah. How have we done so far?
The problem with the 10-year plan, I think, is twofold. First, the plan and the people that actually are responsible for implementing the initiatives of the plan cannot control the feeders of homelessness. They can't control when the state discharges a mentally ill person to homelessness, knowing that the person is going to wind up on the street, or when corrections officials release an inmate who has served their time living with a psychiatric illness and knowing that they're just going to be on the street. We can't control aging out of foster care, and many of the kids coming out of the foster care system have been pretty significantly traumatized by that system. We can't control the broadening income gap. The 10-year plan can't get at those big picture issues. So that's one problem. And then on the back end of the problem, we have never taken the acquisition or production of affordable housing to a scale that approximates the scope of the need. And the reason we haven't is it costs a lot of money.
Well, not to be Pollyanna, but I am going to be, because there must be a bright spot. There must be something that we have done well.
Well, I think we're changing lives of a lot of people all every day, not just at DESC. Seattle is blessed with having a lot of good human service organizations, a lot of good affordable housing development organizations. They want to do it. They've got the technical expertise. We have learned an awful lot about how to successfully serve this population in the last 10 years, and that's because the plan existed. And it isn't a lack of knowledge of how to successfully help someone transition from the street and hopefully reintegrate into the broader social fabric. We know how to do that. The real issue is how committed are we to the production of housing?
So the will is there, but the dollars don't necessarily follow the will?
It's a big price tag. You know, it's got to be close to $1 billion to build enough housing to take everybody out of shelters and all the 3,000 people sleeping on the street. It's a huge price tag. I'm not neglecting that. But don't we take on service projects of equal or greater magnitude all the time? What is the tunnel to replace the viaduct cost? You know, I know that's a painful topic right now for all of us, but we accepted that price tag. How committed are we to helping people that are so extremely marginalized in our community that they're forced to sleep outside?
Why do you do this? Why do you do this 32 years? What keeps you going?
Well, I'm 75, and I was born and raised in the Texas Panhandle into a culture that was racist, misogynist, and homophobic. And I happened to be very smart and chose wisely my parents. And they instilled in me, I think very early on, a very deep-seated sense of social justice, of right and wrong. And quite frankly, when I think about people with mental disorders that are forced to live on the street, it puts a lot of fire in my belly to change this. For the first time in my 30 years at DESC, I am hearing a state legislature begin to pay attention to the mental health system. Prior to this session, the attention that was given to the mental health system was budget cuts for the mental health system, reducing the census at Western State and Eastern State, balancing the state budget on the backs of people living with major psychiatric illnesses. That's just simply wrong. And it's wrong for so many reasons. Mainly it's wrong just for humane reasons. But if you don't want to go there, it's wrong in a cost-benefit sense. Leaving these folks on the street, study after study after study has demonstrated, cost us more as taxpayers than putting them in a housing project like 1811 or some of Plymouth's buildings. It's much less expensive to do that.
Bill Hobson, executive director of Seattle's Downtown Emergency Service Center. He spoke with Marcy Silman.